Matters.
Welcome back to Dork Matters, a dorky podcast for dorks. I'm your dad dork host, Ben Wrinkle, and still with me is Lexi Hunt.
Yep.
Your ad dork hater.
That's the one.
You maybe can tell we are recording this a week after we started it, the second half. One of my children, my oldest, had a night terror, which took about an hour and 45 minutes to deal with. So we did not get back to recording right away that night.
Can I ask about the night terrors? Is it like he sees something?
No, it's just like he's upset about something and he can't communicate.
Like the blanket feels funny, or like I was mad that I didn't get pee.
Something like that. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Or I have to pee, but like I won't go pee. It's not even that usually. It's more just screaming and like doesn't say anything.
Oh God, that's woo.
Hey buddy, can you hear me? No, go away, go away.
I'm like, okay.
But then if you start to go away, he's like, yeah, go back. But he's also like if you talk to him about it later, he's like, no, I don't know that happened. So that's fun. Less frequent than they used to be. They were more frequent when we were prescribed melatonin to help with sleep issues.
Oh, that's interesting.
So after having stopped that last summer, they took a very nice, I guess, succession is the word I'm looking for, in frequency.
Hmm.
But that was the start of a completely stellar week that has just kept going up and up and higher, like a Jesus hymn. Or a Creed song, I suppose.
I mean, same.
Yeah. What's the difference?
Yeah.
They're both a bunch of a-holes who like to pretend that they're righteouser than they are. All well, fucking people that they shouldn't.
Did Jesus do that?
I meant churchy hymn people and Creed.
Yes. Okay. I'm there with you.
Scott Stapp. Nobody thought maybe we don't make this guy popular, the guy with like staph infection as a last name.
Oh, Peter Chlamydia. Oh, yes.
Oh, let's make him a star. Give him a microphone. Can you take me higher? There's one consistency in the male persona, like the en masse persona of male kind. It's the more a person seems to go hard into the paint for a specific thing, the more likely they have run aground it at some point in their life.
Yeah.
But we're not here to talk about Creed. We are here to try to pick up the pieces of our Wes Anderson episode that we stopped recording a week ago.
Yeah, we got it. It's fine.
We can do it. Yeah. I mean, you've seen one Wes Anderson movie, you've seen them all, would be a critique that somebody might make.
Different palettes, yeah.
Where were we, Lex? Would you mind catching people up? And by people, I mean me.
We were in the early stages of talking about Fantastic Mr. Fox, which was...
Let's pretend we said nothing about Fantastic Mr. Fox and launch in.
Okay, so Fantastic Mr. Fox was a film by Mr. Wes Anderson that came out in 2009 and is based on the book by Roald Dahl, Fantastic Mr. Fox. And so just the retelling of it, yeah.
A brief aside, Roald Dahl, generally considered to be a piece of shit, right?
Yes.
Yeah. But also kind of seminal in the realm of kid lit.
Yeah, and kind of like never really shied away from the fact that he was kind of an asshole too. Like, I don't think he was like, nah, I'm a good boy. I think he was just kind of like, yep.
See, I don't know the specifics of his assholery, so I'm not going to say anything too appreciative, but like if you give me a Scott Staff or a Roald Dahl and one of you is pretending that you're righteous and one of you is like, yeah, I'm a piece of shit, I'll go with the one who's admitting that they're a piece of shit. That's more believable and relatable. What I'm saying is, yeah, Roald Dahl over Scott Staff. If there was a little math equation here, the number muncher would be eating Roald Dahl. Did you not get it described to you that way? That little like,
no.
The muncher eats the bigger number. That's how you do those equations in math.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a mouth and it only wants to eat the biggest number.
So the biggest Roald Dahl
traversy?
Oh God, this is a lot worse than I thought it was. Yeah.
Okay, well, okay, I might be walking back my math equation here.
It seems Roald Dahl revision controversy. Okay, so Roald Dahl, according to CNN.com, publicly made a number of anti-Semitic comments throughout his career, including in a 1983 interview with the New Statesman, in which he said, "There is a trait in the Jewish character that does provoke animosity. Maybe it's a kind of lack of generosity towards non-Jews." So that's not great.
No, that's not the sort of thing we want to throw in. Has now let's even this equation. Has Scott Staff said anything anti-Semitic?
I'm looking it up right now.
Or has he just done sex crimes?
Scott Staff.
Staff infection.
Staff.
Scott Staff.
Staff was detained by Florida police in 2002 and charged with reckless driving after he drove his SUV off the road before swerving back into the proper lane.
Why do I feel like he's a sex criminal?
If you look at Quora.com, the first question is, why does Scott Staff of Creed have a reputation for being a jerk? And I think that that is a really funny question. Oh, apparently he was bipolar.
Oh.
So a lot of his condition is based on his mental illness. So,
wow.
Roald Dahl bad. Scott Staff maybe misunderstood.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Misunderstood genius or just misunderstood? Let's not go too far. Misunderstood. And Taylor, I guess, we've learned something.
Sorry, Scott. Not to be so judgy.
The equation is now does not equal.
Yes, does not equal. Anyway, so, but the facts are facts, and Roald Dahl was a children's book author who's created lots of books that are beloved. And I guess a lot of Wes Anderson's work is inspired by it, because we have Fantastic Mr. Fox and then his Netflix show, which we kind of talked about a little bit in the last episode or the first part of the episode.
As we all remember.
Yeah. Especially you, Ben.
As I remember.
If we talk about Fantastic Mr. Fox again, similar cast of character of previous films by Mr. Wes Anderson. So we have people like Jason Schwartzman, Bill Murray, William Dafoe, Owen Wilson, but then we're joined by people like Meryl Streep and George Clooney.
Michael Gambon.
Yeah. This is kind of like a star-studded.
I feel like it's easier to get stars to show up to do voices.
Oh, yeah. Especially in this day and age. Where
they can just roll in their hoodies and underwear or just like go into their closet at home.
Similar. We know that. Can I tell you the one for me that was kind of caught me off guard, the voice? For the voice of Rabbit is Mario Batali. I was like, I wasn't expecting that.
Crisp up those ducks. Drag those chickens. Slow them down just a little bit. We're a little ahead. Where are the apples? Still now? Do you still have them raw? Well, slice them up. Let's get them in the pan.
Yeah. Just celebrity chef Mario Batali out of nowhere.
Like, I guess, sure. So the whole plot of Fantastic Mr. Fox, George Clooney voices Mr. Fox. He kind of goes through a bit of a midlife crisis and wants to get back into the chicken game where he's like stealing stuff from farmers, but he's got a family now and things get more, and a business and things are more complicated. And it's just like, it's kind of a story of his last hurrah, but it really complicates things for his friends and family.
Yeah.
So it's cute.
Yeah, it's fun. You were saying it's one of your favorites, if not top.
Yeah, I do. This is my favorite Wes Anderson movie. I think that it is so well done. I think the cast is so perfect. George Clooney as Mr. Fox is so on point. Just this kind of like debonair, cool guy who loves his family, but is also very conflicted about who he used to be and how hard it is to kind of grow up. And so,
celebrated family man, George Clooney.
Yeah. Well, now, not for a long time.
Well, he's married now, but like, yeah, the joke is that he is for a long time considered the eminent bachelor.
I think so much of Wes Anderson movies are nostalgic, but this one specifically for me, just like drips of like late 70s, early 80s,
everything.
Color palette, it's very like glowy and that kind of like goldenrod.
And at the time, it just feels like such a big swing for Anderson to suddenly be like, and now I'm doing stop motion.
Well, and I'd read a couple controversies about the creation of this, that he wasn't exactly forgiving, understanding, or kind to the animators.
Oh, okay, cool.
And so was treating them kind of like not, he just didn't seem to understand the work that went into stop motion specifically. So, you know, did you ever watch Parks and Recreation?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when Ben makes that stop motion, and he's been like working on it for weeks and weeks, and then it's literally like a minute of film.
Oh my God. That's the whole thing. That's 3 weeks of work. You're going to be okay.
Oh, I've done stop motion.
You know. Friend.
Yeah.
So I think it was that similar kind of thing where he was like, you've been working for months. Show me what you got. It was like 10 minutes. And he was like, what the hell?
maybe we make this a short, Wes.
Yeah.
Wes, how do you feel about shorts?
There's just a couple moments. There's like one specific moment in Fantastic Mr. Fox that I absolutely adore. And it's when they're on the getaway motorcycle towards the end of the movie and they see the fox and they stop and make eye contact with it. Or not, they see the wolf.
The wolf on the hills,
and he like raises a paw like in solidarity and they all do the same thing. And I was just like, I don't know why I love that so much.
What a beautiful creature. Wish him luck, boys.
Good luck out there.
It's a very good moment. It's a beautiful film. Wonderfully made.
Yeah. And the soundtrack is just absolutely, I think, the strongest out of all of them. You have, as we were talking about previously, like the Ballad of Davy Crockett. Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of Beach Boys, Rolling Stones, Jarvis Crocker or Cocker kind of.
Yeah, I'll go in for anything with some Beach Boys in it.
And Bobby Fuller 4, which are just amazing when they, that final scene is so good. So
when they decided to add the fourth person, it was just like, bam. When it's just the Bobby Fuller 3.
Who's Bobby Fuller, Ben?
I fucking don't know. What I'm actually referencing is a joke from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air where they meet that agent who talks about Duran Duran. He says,
yeah, well, when they came to me, they were just Duran. I added the second Duran and bango.
So that's my reference there. Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, for those who are zillennial.
Or unaware. I know.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you what Fresh Prince is. It is not the 2002 or whatever it was, 2020 remake that happened that I was interested in watching but never got around to.
Yeah, I never.
Only made it a season. It was a drama remake.
Oh, no. Like, no, don't do
we're
that.
We're talking like One Tree Hill but via Fresh Prince.
Ooh,
like basketball dramedy. No. Not dramedy, just drama.
Drama.
Yeah. Well, that's Fantastic Mr. Fox. I like Fantastic Mr. Fox. I wouldn't put it at the top of my list personally. It just didn't have that emotional connection for me.
That's fair.
I get that. Did you read Roald Dahl as a kid? Like, is this a story that you had read and then got to see realized in this fashion?
Yeah, it was, but it wasn't like my favorite of the Roald Dahl books. It was something that we read, but it was just the recreation.
So it's not necessarily a nostalgia connection. It's just a beautiful film sort of thing. It just hits for you.
Yeah, I thought it was just wonderful.
Absolutely. Should we move on?
Yeah.
We're going to one of the most critically acclaimed in his collection, Moonrise Kingdom.
Hmm. I find that surprising.
Well, it's not the most. That will be our next one. But it was a sort of like, hey, he's back.
Yeah, and he made a film.
Yeah, but this one's also controversial. Moonrise Kingdom follows, it's sort of a coming-of-age comedy drama. Dramedy, if you will.
Yeah, dramedy.
Appropriately used. You know, and it's written by Anderson and Roman Coppola, but it's got Bruce Willis for the first time. Edward Norton jumps in there. Then we get our usuals with Bill Murray. Frances McDormand is a new one. Tilda Swinton is a first time here, I believe.
Yeah.
And then Schwartzman and some other familiar ones. But basically, there's a kid. He's sort of a weirdo. meets another weirdo introvert and they sort of click. And it's sort of about like this nascent, you know, pubescent sort of attraction. All set to sort of the background of a tumultuous family life, I guess. And a giant storm. A nor'easter.
Like a different type of family too, because the little boy.
Sam, I think.
Sam, he's an orphan who basically just goes to like scout camp, and the scout leader, who's Edward Norton, is basically like a father figure to him. And it's just everything is about like the different types of families and the different relational things that exist between those different types of families. And it's just so awkward. The whole movie is beautiful, but awkward. And that is just that kind of tween love where it's not even teenage love at this stage. Both like 12.
They don't understand themselves, their bodies, their feelings towards each other. They just know that they seem to appreciate being around each other and have some sort of pull towards each other.
Mm-hmm. And they can't quite and their families can't quite figure it out either. And they're just obsessed with each other. But when they get to be with each other, it's very innocent. And like, they just want to like be in each other's company. And it's quite lovely in a really weird, awkward way, which I think is all of Wes Anderson movies.
This is the one that, okay, well, there's a connection coming up here that I don't want to jump ahead of, but I love this little tidbit. But yeah, basically that's the story. They make this connection, forces and parents try to pull them apart. Sam is considered troubled and Susie is, they're trying to pull her away because of his troubled nature. And it leads to them going on the run on this sort of like scout type canoe trip, but really their intent with each other is to run away. And it's all set to sort of the Peter and the Wolf, like the introduction to the orchestra soundtrack, which I love.
In order to show you how a big symphony orchestra is put together, Benjamin Britten has written a big piece of music, which is made up of smaller pieces that show you all the separate parts of the orchestra. These smaller pieces are called variations, which means different ways of playing the same tune.
I don't know how to describe it. It's just, like you said, awkward, and that's just so appealing to me. There's just this, like, climax in a church with, like, lots of singing going on and weird kids being, you know, sort of put into situations that don't make any sense for them to be in, or that are supposed to be innocent but aren't, or something. I don't know. It's just really strange and beautiful. We get a lot of, like, really, like, what I'd consider modern or current Anderson here, which is a lot of, like, straight, very frame shots. Like, those aren't new to him, but he goes really hard here.
Yeah.
With just sort of the composition and the framing. And it's my favorite. I think my favorite part about it, though, is the soundtrack. But yeah, The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra here is just, like, my favorite part of the whole thing. So this one gets a little bit of controversy for the sort of romance when they sort of get into their underwear with each other and start, like, sort of feeling each other up. And it doesn't quite cross the line into, like, creepy, but, like, I guess it bothered enough people that it became an issue at the time.
Yeah, but, I mean, like, people also compared it to Blue Lagoon, where we saw, like, Brooke Shields, and how she was, I don't know how old she was, but she was not, like, she's not even close to 16 or something.
I don't know that much about Blue Lagoon other than it's apparently exploitative for the people involved.
Oh, yeah, it was alarming. I guess you could say, like, the first time I watched it, I was like, my God. So the whole plot of Blue Lagoon is kind of like this this boy and this girl, were they okay, I don't know if they were brother and sister or cousins or just they happen to be marooned together, but they, when they're little kids, they're marooned on an island with another person, and I think it's like the boatmaster or something, and he dies and they have to bury him. And then they grow up together and then they just start like doing it all the time. And it was really alarming because.
And that's the movie.
Yeah, basically. And then they have like a baby and you're like, what is going on? And it won I don't know if it won Oscars, but it was nominated for them. But God, like Brooke Shields was young in it. I have to look up and see how old she was.
Oh man, I know nothing about. We can do that. We can hit a Google. In the meantime, a connection here is that Moonrise Kingdom is also nominated for a Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay.
Oh, she was 14 in it. Boo, gross.
So yeah, that seems
all of her nude scenes were performed by the film's 32-year-old stunt coordinator, Kathy Trout. So at least there's that. But like,
wow. Oof.
The dude that was in the film with her, though, that she was apparently, like, simulating sex with was 18 or 19. So, gross.
Yeah, but they're still sexualizing her for, like, a mass audience. That's wild. That must have been wild to deal with as a 14-year-old kid. Oof.
Well, she talks about that in her biography, about, like, how it wasn't great.
Yeah, no kidding. moving on from Moonrise mm-hmm. Kingdom, as we will in a moment, the last thing I want to say is that this movie, there's a dog character named Snoopy mm-hmm. Who gets killed at some point, where the kids, the sort of bully kids who are pursuing runaway Sam and Susie threaten him, and it comes to violence in a sort of Lord of the Flies kind of way. And instead a dog gets killed, and it inspired a New Yorker editorial called "Does Wes Anderson Hate Dogs?" And the connection here to the future is that it has been surmised by at least a few people that Isle of Dogs is actually his answer to this op-ed. And the reason it's called Isle of Dogs is because it sounds like I love dogs.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yeah. Is there veracity to that? I'm not sure. But yeah, it's been posited that is why I Love Dogs happens, is as a response to this New Yorker article by Ian Croach that says, does Wes Anderson hate dogs? So he made a movie called I Love Dogs, which I thought was hilarious. Also, last thing before we move on from Moonrise is the impending storm that's narrated by what's-his-face, Bob Balaban. It just creates this really impending, like drumming, relentless sort of force of nature that pushes the plot along in a way that is just, it supports that sense of unease that you're talking about, that sort of uncomfortableness. And I really enjoy that.
The barometer reads 28 inches and dropping. Strong winds, as you can see, already at 22 knots. The time is now 4:35.
So let's go. Let's keep moving. Yeah. Now we're getting to the most lauded Wes Anderson film of them all. And it's the Grand Budapest Hotel. Give us a plot summary there, Lex.
It's a heavy one because it's a little bit like an onion. There are many layers to Wes Anderson films where it starts with a story within a story, basically, where it's like a person goes to a celebrated author's grave. And the celebrated author wrote a book about the Grand Budapest Hotel. And I can't remember if it's like a biography or if it's a fictional thing, but at this hotel.
Right. And the book sort of leads us to the narration of the story itself.
And it's this hotel. I think it's like in the 60s kind of time frame. And it's like a love story between multiple people. It's the love story between the hotel and Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah.
Like, he's kind of the head concierge of the hotel, and he's just like the best whip smart kind of concierge you could possibly have.
I need to stop for a second, and this isn't a call out. I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable.
Okay.
But I only learned a couple of years ago that his name is pronounced Rafe.
I wasn't sure if it was Rafe or Ralph.
No, and I just want to talk Rafe about Fiennes. That because there's got to be other people out there who don't know that Ralph Fiennes, literally is spelled Rafe. Ralph Fiennes, could in some way be pronounced Rafe. It's not fair. I feel like you need to spell that phonetically if you want anyone to get that right.
Well, it's like, so Vincent van Gogh's brother, Theo, when I was in the Netherlands, I was told by some people that there is the name Theo in the Netherlands, but there's also the name Theo, which is spelt the exact same as Theo.
Hmm.
And they're like, so some people call him Theo. And I was like, so is he Theo or Theo? And they were like, like, great. So this was a super helpful concert.
Both, I guess. Yeah. Why wouldn't it be both? I mean, names are not consistent through every sort of culture and language. We do approximations or best pronunciations in different spellings. So I am making a mountain out of a molehill here, I guess. I just want to talk about it because I did not know forever. I called him Ralph Fiennes forever. Nobody corrected
Rafe,
me.
Rafe Fiennes. Yeah, anyway.
Rafe.
So Rafe is the concierge whose people come to the hotel because of him. And the story is also about like a bellhop, I guess you could say. And his name is Tony.
Zero.
Yeah, Zero is the character, but played by Tony Revolori.
Revolori. Yeah, so in a much, much, much previous episode, this is the character who I got confused for somebody else when we were talking about the TV version of Willow.
Yes. Yes.
But yeah, this is sort of his break-in moment.
And he's fantastic. Absolutely, like, the perfect person for the role. So he falls in love with, like, a scullery maid or a baker at the hotel, played by, please don't make me say her name, Schwarzy, Schwar, Saoirse Ronan. You know what I'm talking about.
No, that's I don't fucking know how to say that. Saoirse Ronan. I'm joking. I think it's just Saoirse Ronan. Saoirse, if you want to correct us, please feel free to send in an audio clip of how to pronounce your name properly.
How to pronounce Saoirse Ronan.
It's Saoirse, but it's easier for Americans and English people to say Saoirse or Sasha.
What was the difference?
Saoirse is how Irish people say it.
And how do Americans say it?
Saoirse.
Sounds kind of the same.
Sounds the same. Okay.
I thought that's how you say it, but I know that I'm absolutely butchering this beautiful Celtic name, so I apologize. And then there's just like this wonderful cast of like super eccentric characters, and you think it's going to be this kind of like Zazzy, wild Wes Anderson movie, and then all of a sudden becomes this true dramedy about fascism because the hotel gets taken over by this like Nazi-esque fascist government.
I mean, they're just Nazis. They're just Wes Anderson's Nazis. Yeah. They use pink instead of red.
The hotel is taken over, and the concierge is standing up against these fascists, and I think, like, spoiler alert, I mean, it's been out for a while, but...
Spoilers!
Ralph Fiennes' character is killed, and it was this moment...
I think you mean Ralph.
But I just wasn't expecting that to happen, where I was like, and then he gets up, and he's going to be just fine. And they're like, no, he's dead. I'm like, oh, God, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it takes a pretty dark turn. And yeah, there's this whole subplot with like the will of a very rich patron of Rafe's and of the hotels and sort of that financial windfall. And end of the story is basically it all ends up with Zero, who lives his life out at the Grand Budapest Hotel as his sort of fortune rises. The hotel itself sort of takes a nosedive and just sort of ages into decay and post-fascist Europe, you know?
Yeah.
And it's sort of a bittersweet story that then ends back where it starts with that, the sort of book being closed.
And I loved in this one because one of my most favorite movies, like my top 10, Lemony Snicket, Jude Law is the author of, like, who does the narration of Lemony Snicket. He's also the author, narrator in this one as well. I love
yes, the young author in 1968.
Yeah, so we love Jude Law.
Who's this interesting old fellow? I inquired of Monsieur Jean. To my surprise, he was distinctly taken aback.
Don't you know?
He asked.
Don't you recognize him?
He did look familiar.
That's Mr. Mustafa himself. He arrived early this morning.
This name will no doubt be familiar to the more seasoned persons among you.
And then Thomas Wilkinson as the older version of the author. Towards the end.
The incidents that follow were described to me exactly as I present them here, and in a wholly unexpected way.
Yeah, I don't know. This is probably one of my favorites. I would put it top three, I think. It just feels about something more interesting than some of the other ones.
Yeah.
Like, I know, like, I need to choose my words here. His movies are about something. And
yeah.
You know, you can make arguments about what that is. This one just felt a little bit more interesting and possibly as a response to sort of the people talking about his approach to movie making being, finger quotes, white culture.
Yeah.
About talking about some sort of other aspect of it or of a character for once who was not a, you know, white person as a main character.
Yeah.
I don't know why. It's just more interesting that way. There is a lot more to say. And we get like just a ridiculous Adrian Brody performance.
I like Adrian Brody is a weird dude, and I love it when you let people let their freak flag fly in an appropriate, respectful, safe way. Like it's the same thing with Lemony Snicket. I think it's Jim Carrey's strongest role because he just gets to be weird in it. And so like Adrian Brody as a weirdo is awesome.
Dr. Eggman from Sonic the Hedgehog would like to have a conversation about Jim Carrey's most wild to the wall performance. While we're on comparisons to other movies, though, I want to draw one, which is the sort of prison stuff in this film and the escape from prison.
Yes.
There's a movie called Paddington 2, which is just a beautiful film, actually. No joke.
Really?
Like, it's hilarious and awesome. And it I don't have any proof of this, but I believe it draws heavily on Grand Budapest Hotel and the aesthetics of Wes Anderson. And it is funny.
I love it. I'm going to watch it.
Very, very funny. You should. You should watch both of them, but the second one's even better. But they're both actually surprisingly fun films. But Paddington 2 just like goes for it aesthetically in a way that the first one didn't, and just does something all its own that is not necessarily hung on, you know, the nostalgia or the previous stories of Paddington. But it's directed by Paul King. But there's just this wonderful, like, he spends time in prison and it's wonderful. It's fantastic. He at one point is doing laundry and dyes everybody's stuff pink by accident, and I think he wins over everybody in the prison by making a marmalade cake or something like that.
That's super cute.
But it's just hilarious, and a lot of the staging and framing and the photography of it is feels very Wes Anderson-y to me. I'm going to make that a recommendation.
Okay, I'm going to watch it. Doing it.
All right. Let's move on to the one movie on this list I have not watched.
Really?
There was so much controversy about Isle of Dogs when it came out. And I was also on my way to having my first child.
So we got a little bit busy. Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to watch this movie. And then that choice just stopped being a choice. I had a kid. Yeah. And I was just like, oh, I have never had a chance to watch this now. And I should, but I just feel like I missed the moment.
All right.
So what do you have to say about Isle of Dogs? What can you tell us?
I have to, like, I was just looking over like the Wikipedia plot summary because it's been a while since I've seen it. But from what I remember, it was this kind of, in the future, dogs are illegal or they're sick or something. There's like a dog flu and dogs are banned in Japan. And I'm not sure if it's in the world or if it's just in Japan. And so there's a person who flies an airplane to the only place in Japan where there are dogs. And it's this little island where all the stray dogs were left when they, like, the outbreak first happened. And it's this young boy who gets trapped on the island and is trying to find his way off of the island with the help of dogs. And it's just this kind of like there and back again type story where he learns that the dogs are actually not sick. And it was a big conspiracy. I don't remember why there was a conspiracy. And the dogs eventually get off the island and everybody finds out that it's okay to have a pet dog. That's what I remember.
Yeah. You know, you got me. I did not watch this one. I don't know. I don't have anything to say. I've read more about the controversy about it than I...
What is the controversy? I don't think I know.
Okay, so it's about the portrayal of Japanese culture by noted sort of, again, finger quotes, white culturalist Wes Anderson. And I don't want to do a shitty job, so I'll just read here. But basically, racial stereotypes and cultural appropriation.
Okay.
The Japanese characters also speak unsubtitled Japanese, so their dialogue is instead translated by an interpreter or a machine. So Justin Chang from Los Angeles Times wrote that it's in the director's handling of the story's human factor that his sensitivity falters and the weakness for racial stereotyping that has sometimes marred his work, his previous work, comes to the fore. Much of the Japanese dialogue has been pared down to simple statements that non-speakers can figure out based on context and facial expressions. And I definitely read some more positive takes on it. Moiko Fuji, who wrote for The New Yorker, said that Anderson's decision to not subtitle the Japanese speaker struck me as a carefully considered artistic choice. Isle of Dogs is profoundly interested in the humor and fallibility of translation. This is the beating heart of the film. There is no such thing as true translation. Everything is interpreted. Translation is malleable and implicated always by systems of power. The film shows the seams of translation and demarcates a space that is accessible and funny only to Japanese viewers. So their take was that this isn't about cultural appropriation for a white audience. He's actually done the Japanese portion intentionally very much for them, for an audience that can only hear it. So, yeah, and then he constructs the criticisms of the character of Tracy Walker being a white savior as well. So there's obviously back and forth.
Yeah, like I can see that.
And from people who have a stake in sort of the representation of Japanese culture in it, which is nice that those are the people that are speaking on how this plays in that aspect. So, yeah, that's basically all I know about the film. So unless you've got more to say, let's keep it moving.
Let's go.
French Dispatch.
I found this one French Disboring.
A lot of people did, and I enjoyed it a lot. I like the vignette sort of situation going on with it.
It seems like that part of the Wes Anderson storytelling was very on point. I think he does a great job with shorter bursts, like chapters or these vignettes. I think it was smart, but I just was kind of like, meh.
Yeah.
It's pretty, but like, I just, this one was not a win for me.
Yeah, that's fair. You know, it's been a while now since I've watched this, but I just remember being like, this is what I go to a Wes Anderson film for. It's clever. The disparate pieces seem to sort of come together at some point in the narrative to do something interesting. I'm trying to remember. This is the one with the the painter who plays the painter guy.
Benicio del Toro.
Del Toro, yeah. And that whole thing is interesting. His sort of giant painting thing. I wish I could remember this better, which is probably a good argument for why we should only two episodes when we've recently reviewed material.
It's about, it's, again, it's like a late 60s, early 70s, a French... it's a newspaper, and so it's just, it's a collection of stories by the eccentric cast of newspaper writers and editors.
Right.
And then their stories also have like a wild cast of characters doing weird shit.
And this one is also set to sort of the background of political upheaval. And
this is the first time that we have like a young Timothy Chalamet.
A Chevrolet.
Yes.
It's actually Timothy Chevrolet.
Okay, good. So,
is it funny to mess up names?
I just don't know how to say his name properly. Timothy Chalamet. Chalamet. And this is the first time that we also have Christopher Walken in a Wes Anderson movie, which I find shocking.
Yeah.
We would have had more Walken by now.
I wonder if that's because, Wes seems like he uses a lot of the same actors, but they're people that can really embody sort of character roles.
It's true, but at the same time, too, you have like...
And Walken is always just sort of Walken.
But so I would argue so is Owen Wilson.
Fair enough.
But then you have like the range of like, again, William Dafoe, Angelica Houston.
Yeah, Tilda Swinton is back.
Like, we also have Harry Winkler.
Henry Winkler, the Fonz, yeah. Hey, forget about it.
Yes, the Fonz is here.
Money, please. Parks and Rec, if you will. Yeah. Christoph Waltz is here as well. Jeffrey Wright, who I love, is fantastic in this one.
Liv Schreiber.
Also known as...
he's great.
Sabretooth from the... Wolverine Origins movie.
Yes, we do have that.
And Swarzy Ronan is back.
Edward Norton, Bill Murray, Elizabeth Moss, who I, whatever.
Versus.
No, it's, we're starting to get into that giant, like, not that his past casts haven't been massive, but this one is just basically like, how many stars can we shove in here? And it's kind of like people are coming out of the woodwork to be like, I was here also, and then they're out.
I mean, and there's obviously that like stage play quality to it all. It's basically just feels like he's cast everybody that he's friends with in the high school, and they're all doing their stage play, and everybody gets a part.
Is Wes Anderson like the human curator of like human Muppets? Like, is this like the Muppet Show where at the end they all kind of come out on stage and wave like a Muppet? Because there's so many like recognizable.
I mean, if Wes Anderson ever directed a Muppet movie, I think we'd have something really fantastic.
I think our heads would explode.
Also, somebody just posited on Reddit today in direct relation to our previous episode. What's his name? Glass Onion, Knives Out. What's his name? Benedict Blank, is that it? Or something Blank?
Benoit Blank.
Benoit Blank? Yeah. A Benoit Blank film where it's just what's his fuck as Benoit Blank and everybody else is Muppets. It's a murder mystery.
Oh, that would be good. An Agatha Christie type murder mystery, but all Muppets. Love it. Yeah, that'd be great.
But it's all Muppets and Benoit Blank and 007 himself, whose real name for some fucking reason I can't remember.
Daniel Craig.
Daniel Craig is the only human in it playing against...
That would be good. Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. So I enjoyed this one. Whatever.
Yeah, it's fine.
Oh, fuck.
Last one. Here we go.
We're circling the drain here. We can get through this episode. Guys, when you make a podcast, they can't all be, you know.
Rockstar episodes.
Rockstar episodes. Sometimes you have to come back to something you were really ready to do a week ago and try to cobble your notes and thoughts together on it. Our most recent 2023 Wes Anderson flick, Asteroid City, which I really enjoyed.
I liked elements of it, but at the end, I was just like, an alien, huh? Okay, all right.
Well, that's not even the wackiest part of it. We get into his play within a play thing here again, which is like, there are such intentional choices in this to just confound sort of a movie-going audience. Like, because it's a play within a play, there's characters doing like sort of screen directions or like we're getting behind the scenes of the play itself sort of aspects to things. And you have to follow those separately from the story that we're being told as well.
Yeah.
And the story being told itself, which feels like sort of a pastiche or a take on a Wes Anderson film itself. So it's even more amped up yet again from what he would have done himself.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing finally ends and I think everyone's dead or something. I can't remember. Spoiler alert.
Everybody dies and then go home. No, everybody just leaves.
I think they literally just fall asleep, don't they, or something at the end?
No, people just leave.
In the classroom or whatever where they're talking about the analysis of the play. Because there's the classroom, right? I'm trying to remember all the layers to this onion. There's the classroom, which is like a school or something that is analyzing what's happening in the play.
It's not a classroom. It's like they're on like a TV set, like a Saturday Night Live TV set.
Was that it? I thought it was like a lecture hall.
Well, same. It's just like they're in like a documentary kind of thing.
Oh, I thought they were giving like a talk about the performances and stuff. And so everybody who is a character in the play within a play is also sitting in that audience.
Oh, no, you're right. It was like a little, like a theater.
Yeah.
Classroom, like
a theater troupe, where they're doing a lecture or not a lecture, but an analysis and breakdown of this staging of this play of this author's work, because there's a narrator talking about it at the same time, and then you go from there into the vignettes of the people making this work, and what they're doing behind the scenes there, which then takes us deeper still into the actual play that we're seeing, which is where you get all the characters and stuff like that.
Yeah, there we go. Okay, I've got it now. I'm starting to mix this one up with the Netflix. Because at this point, like, I would say, like, the current Netflix ones, the palette is very, like, foggy and muted. And this one was very, like, burnt out, blown out, Texas, desert. But things are starting to meld together for me for Wes Anderson, which
is, I think, probably one of the criticisms people level at him. Yeah.
Yeah.
A sameness to things.
Like, I love them. It's like putting on a warm blanket because you're like, Wes Anderson, it's going to be weird and cozy.
Yes, I'm comfortable with this and beautiful and well staged, like, especially from our art school kid sort of perspective.
But it's so, like, kind of muted and bland that it's all just kind of the same at this stage.
Yeah, at this point, characters walk out of like backstage areas and open doors to weird sort of like fire escapes in some sort of fictitious New York and like talk to each other in metatextual sense.
Yes. And smoke.
About like reciting lines from the play itself. And then, it's just wild.
And then we're going into the like, and then they were dead all along. Yeah, or like, then like they died.
Somebody
and
died.
Like, oh, God. Yeah. Edward Norton's character, like, he's like the playwright. It ends with him dying in a car accident. Yeah. And I remember thinking, like, what?
And I believe he has sort of, he's gay and is hiding it at some point throughout the show or something like that.
Yeah. I just kind of feel like we're getting to this stage where it's too much. And what I really liked about those earlier, like Life Aquatic or Royal Tenenbaums, like it was a pretty simplistic story told in a complicated fashion. And now everything is just like
a complicated story told in an overly simplistic fashion. I feel like this is...
No, now it's like overly complicated in every aspect.
I feel like this is one that we're going to come back to later. It's going to be cult classic. People are going to like analyze it in years to come and be like, oh, this is actually one of his most brilliant pieces because he really goes for it in a way that's silly and over the top. Maybe
I
not.
I still won't like it. I'll still be like, Fantastic Mr. Fox is the best one.
What's she talking about? I don't know. There's some director when she was young. Nobody knows.
Oh, God. That's a depressing thought, isn't it? But true. I mean, I don't know. Accurate.
I'm just memeifying.
How are we ending this?
I don't know. Fuck, we got no good end. This is a real...
Well, So you think the best Wes Anderson is Grand Budapest?
I mean, what's best? Like, fuck, are we really going to do that on our show? Like, I mean, we're not that kind of people. We have our favorites. That's fine. We have ones that we like.
Okay, so what do you want to see next from him? Like, what would be your dream Wes Anderson?
I honestly don't care. Oh. Like, I can just make something and I'll watch it. And it'll be, like you said, comforting nostalgia for me. It's just a blanket of aesthetics and color that I really enjoy. Did you know that little Roadrunner at the beginning is a puppet?
No, I didn't know that.
Like, it's a stop motion puppet.
Oh, did I know that? I don't think I did.
I don't think it dances and shit. So, you know, it's not a real Roadrunner.
I don't remember it at all.
And like, it's just like, you know, make what you want. And I guess that's what I like about Wes Anderson. He does not seem to have made anything that he did not want to make.
Yeah, I do appreciate that.
He's not a studio, so to speak, you know, film creator. He makes what he wants to make. And it has been enjoyable for all its foibles and flaws and fair criticisms levied against it. So I think if he just keeps making whatever the hell he wants to make, I'll probably enjoy the next one too.
I want him to make the Chronicles of Narnia.
Oh, who is making the Chronicles of Narnia? It's what's-her-face. Barbie, Greta Gerwig.
Ooh, I still want it to be Wes Anderson because I think it'd be pretty.
You know what I want from Wes Anderson is our next Muppet film.
Yeah, I would like that a lot.
Wes Anderson's Muppet of Monte Cristo.
Muppet and Commander.
Oh,
Muppet and Commander, or Muppet Cristo,
no, you know
whatever.
What? Muppet and Commander does seem like it would lend itself more to being a Wes Anderson sort of thing.
Yeah, because he's good with boats.
He's good with boats.
He would be great with that.
Our final
he's a good boat guy.
Wes Anderson is. He's good with boats.
Maybe like he thinks he's nautical.
He's nautical.
Should he remake Pirates of the Caribbean?
Oh my god, that'd be pretty good. With Muppets or without?
I don't know who's to say that. I think it could go
either
way.
What if
he
turned all of his main cast into Muppets and then had them voice themselves? For a
film.
That
would be pretty funny. The Jason Schwartzman Muppet.
Oh my God. He's already a Muppet, isn't he?
He basically is, yeah.
Is everyone a Muppet? Adrian Brody is a Muppet. Tilda Swinton's
Bill
a Muppet.
Murray.
Angelica
Absolutely.
Houston, Bill Murray. They're both Muppets.
They're all Muppets. That's what I mean.
Oh my God. We've cracked it. Wes Anderson has just been making
Muppet movies.
Human Muppet films the entire time.
He's the human Muppet master.
He's Jim Henson, but for people.
Oh, this is awesome.
Wow. What a breakthrough. Come back for our next episode of wildly insightful and not at all stilted recordings. And until then, dork to dork dork.
Dork dork.
Thanks for listening to Dork Matters. If you like the podcast, subscribe, give us a rating, and tell your friends about us.
If you are a fellow dork and have a dork issue that you think we need to discuss, tell us on our social media. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter. You can also check out original art and other content from Ben and myself.
We'd like to say a big thank you to Yabra for the use of our theme song, Dance, off of their Astral EP, as well as a thank you to Jess Schmidt for producing and editing our podcast. Thanks, Jess.
Dork Matters.
This podcast is created on the traditional territories of the Blackfoot Nations, which includes the Siksika, the Bagaini, and the Kainai. We also acknowledge the Stoney Nakoda Nation, Sutena, and Métis Nation, Region 3.